On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Drew Johnson about his brand new book on what Darwin has to do with Scripture. So we cover all sorts of topics like, what in the world does Darwin have to do with Scripture? Should we really be thinking about how Darwin can fit or connect to the Scriptures in any way? Is that relevant in any sense? How does the biblical literature present a coherent and sustained intellectual culture that rivals or compares to something like what Darwin had done? And how do we prioritize the biblical authors' own metaphysical frameworks and values and priorities as we read and interpret Scripture and much, much more?
As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast all about serious thinking for a serious church. And in thinking seriously, we've tried to explain that as creating and cultivating and sustaining an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. So if you're a regular listener, you know we talk to all sorts of people across the spectrum. They believe all sorts of stuff, some of them crazy, some of them normal. And that's part of it. That's what's fun. We're trying to help people think critically and to think with in a way that says, I could make a new friend here. Maybe I disagree with them, but at least I have a new intellectual partner that I can learn and ask maybe new questions that I haven't thought of in the past that can help open up potential problems that I've had and help me think about something in a new way. Today, I'm excited to introduce you all to Dr. Drew Johnson. If you don't know Drew, we've had him on the podcast before. You can go check out that old episode. And Drew is always fun to talk with. And we're going to be talking about his new book with IVP, What Hath Darwin to Do with Scripture? So this will be especially fun because it's a spicy topic. And I've got Cody Float here joining me. And Cody is the real expert on reading the Bible. I'm a philosopher. We don't read the Bible. It's a joke. It's a joke. You're supposed to read the Bible. But that it's just fun to say that Cody is our resident Bible reader on the team. So he'll be able to ask all the good questions. So Drew, before we jump in, tell me a little bit about yourself, where are you at now, and what was the inspiration for writing this book?
I am in Holland, Michigan, looking out my window at snow blowing right now. And I was telling Cody it was 70 degrees and everybody was in shorts and t-shirts yesterday. Dropped 50 degrees last night. So I'm at Hope College here on a one-year visiting appointment, I am probably going to be working on this same topic of creation and evolution for the next 4 years with Jewish, Christian, and Muslim scholars out of England, most likely, it's looking like. So this is what turned out to be kind of a side project to my kind of main research interest has now turned into a main project for at least a little while. I don't know what inspired this. I think mainly what inspired it is kind of like everything in my life. I got annoyed with the current conversations. And then I was like, oh, I should write something. And the more I wrote about it, the more I thought about it. This was one of the weird ones where I thought like, oh, there's more here than I thought. And then I had a sabbatical when I was working at the King's College in New York City. And TEDS had a program that was specifically for creation and evolution for scholars to come work those issues out. So I got to spend a whole semester commuting back and forth every week from New York City to TEDS, which was really fun. Getting on the plane on Monday morning. Yeah, I was every Monday morning, like at 4 a.m., I went to the airport and got to the office before everybody else who was living there did. And then I left at Thursday evening and it was incredibly productive because I was away from my wife. And I had technically had a 3-day weekend every weekend, although that didn't work out quite like I thought it would. But I could work 14 or 16 hours a day, 4 days in a row, and just get a ton of work done. So in some ways, it was really fun. My poor wife, though, she is the hero of this book because our kids were all teenagers at that point, and they were going through all the things normal teenagers go through, and she was having to bear the brunt of it that semester. So that's the real story of the book.
I like it. Yeah. I think sometimes we forget what's going on in people's lives as they write books and, or record podcasts. When we were all at home from COVID for like 3 years, right, every single podcast, I have at least one child in the background doing something.
Right.
which doesn't come through in the recordings, but except on very rare occasions where you hear them like screaming like little chickens in the background or something.
There are a few OnScript episodes, maybe two, where my cat features in them because I was at home during COVID.
Awesome. So I guess I'll get started. You know, it's a provocative question to put on the title, which of course is helpful for sales and everything. So just tell me in a nutshell, in your mind, what are you trying to do with the question? What does Darwin have to do with scripture? Does he have anything to do at all? Like what's the framework here?
Yeah. Well, first the caveat, authors do not choose the titles of their books. That was no author, unless you're Tom Wright or, you know, someone really famous, you don't get to choose the title of your book. So it's provocative because the marketing department chooses the title. But what do they have to do with it? It's based on this old famous quote from Tertullian about Jerusalem and Athens. And the issue is, I think most people just think nothing, right? It's almost a rhetorical question with the implied answer of, yeah, nothing do they have to do with each other. And I think it just at some point, you know, I'd studied natural selection as an undergrad. I was a social science major. So in psychology, it came up all the time, kind of as the black box of explanation. You know, at the end of explaining some behavior and say, of course, some evolutionary process led to this behavior we're not quite sure of, or it led to survival mechanisms or something like that. A lot of mystery mongering I heard as an undergrad. And so I was always intrigued, even before I was a Christian, I was kind of intrigued with like, what do we fill that box in with? Like, what's actually going on in the mechanics there? And then as I got to working in Genesis 1 through 11, and it's actually on writing a little layperson's kind of common sense commentary on Genesis 1 through 11 through Lexham, I think when I was working on that as well, I must have been reading something. It just struck my mind like, wait, the biblical authors talk about scarcity of resource that leads to violence. They talk about sexual propagation. Actually, it's one of their favorite topics, at least in Genesis, sexual propagation. And they talk about whether people are fit to their habitat or not. Like people are not just people, but animals are made for habitats. Habitats are created and then animals appropriate to those habitats fill them. So I suspect that there was some kind of folk natural selection, like how things fit to their environment going on. I honestly was a little surprised by how deep it went. Like the more I looked into it, the more I was like, oh yeah, actually they're, it's like a three-stranded cord. They're tying this conversation together very much like Darwin does. And so then there are later questions like why, you know, when I started looking at the history of stories about origins, I couldn't find any other cultures that talked about what Darwin would later call natural selection. So there's this whole other question like, why in the history of humans do only the Hebrews and then later Wallace and Darwin talk about this kind of structure? And of course, it's not only them, but I don't have an answer to that question. It was just an interesting question. I mean, one answer would be Darwin is noticing things about the world that the biblical authors also noticed. And then they just had some overlap in their explanations and some clear distinctions between their explanations as well. So in some way, I wanted the title, just to go back to the title issue, my working title was what did Darwin and Scripture notice? And kind of focusing on what they're both tuned into and then showing how they have two different explanations.
Yeah, that seems clear to what you're doing, but less provocative to get people excited to buy the book.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
I'll say this, Drew, you know, every interview we do, I try to read a portion of whatever it is that the person we're talking to. I can't read everything, obviously, because that would require me to actually be a full-time paid podcaster. But your book, I got it in the mail and I was like, okay, I'm going to read, you know, the first chapter or two, and then I'm going to pick one or two that I want to read. And I actually enjoyed it so much that I kept reading.
I'm sorry.
I'll commend the book in that sense. It's well written. It's interesting. It's engaging. It's asking interesting questions. So
I left
I
sex
really
for the end,
it.
So you got to plow through to get to sex. Yeah,
yeah, that's great. So I guess the question of, you know, if someone looks at this and they get tense because they see Darwin's name, what's the sort of like 30-second explanation that you would give for like why should you even care about thinking about Darwin?
Yeah. I get tense too when I see Christians working with Darwin on both sides. But that's exactly the problem. It's you're on one side or the other. You're either pro or you're trying to tear him down. And I kind of wanted to just show, like, hey, Darwin had really good insights about how the world actually works. And I mean, the modern evolutionary science will have significant modifications to what Darwin says, but I think a lot of what he was seeing is how the world actually works. Of course, most of what he's seen and documented in natural selection is not evolution as we know it. He's actually just talking about birds, for one example, in the Galapagos, how do their bodies change according to the environment in some way? And lots of people were talking about this issue. In the church, there's lots of discussion over the history of the church about whether races were made for places or, places caused races to emerge. So everybody was thinking about how much the environment factors in the shape of human bodies, of animal bodies, et cetera. And so in some ways, I just want to take Darwin off of bumper sticker mentality and put him back into, this is a thinking guy trained for the clergy at Cambridge University. He knew lots of stuff, but he was really fascinated with creation. And I will say this, Darwin paid closer attention to creation than any anti-Darwinist I know. And I mean that in the sense of people who just flippantly go reject Darwin. He was more tuned into the way the world actually works, and really concerned to kind of puzzle it together. And so I don't say any of this in the book, but my commendation of Darwin is he's doing exactly what God designed him to do. He's looking at all this different information that he's gathering from going up and down the coast of South America and tracking all these different animals and locations. And he's trying to piece together, how do I explain all of these differences and what's going on? And I mean, this is what we want our children to do when we train them, right? So in many ways, I want to commend him as a notable, virtuous character who's curious about the world and really trying to figure things out. If I were to critique him, I'd say he has a desperate lack of theological metaphysics. but I mean, that's just a Tuesday for a lot of people. So
a question, I guess this is more of a broad question as relates to the project in general. So that just sort of like the faith science dialogue sort of stuff. And it seems that even today, we're past a lot of the sort of fundamentalist modernist stuff from the early 20th right. century. But in a lot of ways, the ghost still remains of where there's uncomfortability of should we be even considering the potential of harmonizing some of these voices together? What's your pitch on this to help people to see that it's not something that should be fearful or anxiety driving? How do you explain that?
Yeah, I was a psychology major, and I was actually going to go into a PhD in psychology. I was pretty serious in it before I got diverted into seminary. And I thought a lot about this as a new Christian. What do I do with all this psychology that I'm learning? And I think what I came to appreciate in the social psychology department was that good psychologists are very tentative about what they think they know. And psychology lends itself, chemistry does not lend itself as much to being tentative. Some facets of it do, but psychology, they'd say the data tend to show. We think we understand this. Or there's a lot of, we used to think this, but that was on a behaviorist model, et cetera. And so I think, the caricature of science is that, if Neil deGrasse Tyson is the spokesperson for what scientists think and know, then yeah, we should all be nervous about the idea that we're trying to join these two things together because he's got these weird assumptions about what science can and can't do that, quite honestly, a lot of scientists have. But I think what we can look into any scientific research and we can say, hey, if it's good science, it should get us closer to a truer understanding of reality. And then we kind of have to figure out how that, fits with what scripture is saying, right? And I don't think if it's going to say I'm trying to think of even an example where science would say something that is just theologically obtuse, where our theology, I don't think it's trying to comport our theology to scientific findings. I think if we could put it in a very basic sense, if I touch a hot stove and it burns my hand, once I could be, well, that was random, right? The second time you're all right, a pattern. This is inductive reasoning at work. Nobody says, well, that has nothing to do with my theology. That fire can burn me, no, that's actually a theological issue, that fire can burn us and that we can drown in water, et cetera. So I think we're all doing this. It's whether we do it poorly or well. And then I think you can open widely, when people are asking me, well, where did you land on evolution and all this stuff after this project? I said, I'm more agnostic than ever on issues of evolution, not on issues of God, but issues of evolutionary explanation. I'm more like, I don't know. Like, I'm holding a lot of it out with a 20-foot pole going like, I'm not sure what to think about a lot of things. But I'm curiously optimistic that I will get more clarity in the next decade or two. And that's fine. Like, I don't need to like come to any conclusions about it. I think people are looking for reasons to like when they come to this conversation, they're same thing with like gender and sexuality. They're often looking for reasons to shoot a position down quickly and move on to something else. And I think the current explanations kind of still leave us in this state of like, I think we still need to listen more closely for a longer period of time and see where it goes. That does not mean I'm not leaning in any particular direction. I just, so when I talk about putting science in conversation with scripture, I'm not saying bend one to the other. I'm just saying put them in conversation, like see what they have to say to each other. And at the end of the book, you know, I basically say, I don't think science understands itself as well as scripture understands science. So that's kind of where I end. And if they did, then things might be, then we might be able to have better conversations.
Yeah. So Cody, I'm sorry, I'm dominating. I have one more like big picture question I want to ask Drew, and then I'll let you ask questions. One of the things I think you harp on in a lot of your work is sort of like the biblical imagination, like the imagination that's ongoing in the Hebrew world and the authors of the Bible. They're working with their own set of assumptions, their own like sort of like, I don't know, I think you use the terminology of an intellectual world.
Yeah, I use that a lot.
And I think that is distinct from what a lot of scholars are doing today, where the sort of the intellectual world is no longer the intellectual world of the Bible, but the intellectual world of the third or fourth centuries.
Right.
Or pick whatever the golden century is.
Right.
In your mind, what is this sort of biblical intellectual world, and why is it so important to think about it and to allow that to some degree determine some of our categories and the questions that we ask and the roads and the paths that we travel?
Yeah, I was just ranting on Twitter about this today, one, the issue of the soul, right? And yeah, I think I don't know what to call it. I don't want to say anti-Semitism, because obviously that has a very specific meaning in our culture. But there is almost like an anti-Hebraism, where like these people weren't smart enough to figure out complex ideas. So instead, they told us stories, you know? But now, you know, after Plato, we now know how to do real discursive analysis, and now we can talk about theology. And I think that story is being steadily debunked by lots of people in lots of different regions. Even by systematic theologians are no longer fully satisfied with that story, I think, for a lot of them. And what I mean by intellectual world is the biblical authors have their own way of conceptualizing abstract ideas. They do it quite differently than people, believe it or not, people in the Enlightenment or people in the third or fourth centuries. Well, depending on where you live in the third or fourth centuries, if you're in sub-Saharan Africa, then yeah, actually you might have something very close to what the biblical authors are doing. If you're in North Africa, in the Romanized Africa, probably not. Maybe some, maybe not. So they have a way of describing and analyzing what they think are true. I hate to say natures, because one of my friends pointed out, well, that's still, you're in a Greek term there as well. But there are objective aspects to reality that we all have to deal with. And it's not free floating. It's not like every chair is an independent object that has no relation to any other chair in the world, right? And the biblical authors are aware of this, and they want to discuss it. So with the soul, I was talking about in Genesis, where it says he breathed the breath of life into man, and people like to call that the soul. And I'm like, clearly not. In the previous chapter, it just talks about the breath of life in every animal. Later in chapter 7, it talks about everything with the breath of life that was killed in the flood, animals and humans, right? So breath is something like an animating force. Obviously, nefesh, which gets translated soul, unfortunately, typically refers to the entire human body, or what we call the human being, I guess, today. So someone pushed back, and they're like, okay, well, what did they think this was? And I was like, well, actually, I think they do have a very coherent account of animating forces in living creatures. They probably have an account of something that we would call the inner life, or that we might want to call the soul. But you have to follow a lot of stories and a lot of poetry and legal reasoning and fictional examples, like parables in later stories, where they're going to lay out what they think this is. They're not going to give it to you in one, like, okay, let's define what a soul is. And now that you know what it is, because, and I think, I actually think there's a reason for this, is that their stated goal is that this Torah would make Israel into a wise and discerning people. And wisdom and discernment is not found by giving definitions and then instances and then saying, okay, let me give you an exam, a multiple choice exam to see whether you memorize definitions. Wisdom is found out by, I give you a new incoherent glob of information. And because you have embodied lots of different aspects of this abstract reality in concrete instances, you can kind of make hay and figure out what's going on with this new amorphous thing that I've shown you. That's just very different than trying to hand people data, make them memorize it, or analyze by deconstruction, or analyze by atomism, by taking it into its essential parts. They think the world comes in mass, collected features, and you can talk about things in parts, but as soon as you do, you got to remember how they're related to the whole. And that's their intellectual world. I honestly think we as Christian theologians have not gotten to the point where we fully respect their intellectual world. We're like, they're telling stories about religion and righteousness and spiritualism and piety, and the theology is really done by the later Greek people. And I think that that's, I don't know, that's kind of inhuman. It's like, I don't have a word for it. I don't want to call it, again, anti-Hebrew. I don't know. I don't want to call it prejudice, racist. I don't know. But it's kind of like in that, it vibes with those terms, if you know what I mean, right? For all the Gen Zers out there, it's giving racism.
Sweet. So diving into the particulars of the book, so I find your book fairly uncontroversial upon reading it. You know, you enter into it.
So did I. Again,
yeah, but again, it's like, well, having also, you know, read and really enjoyed your book on biblical philosophy, I saw this book really is just an expression of what that looks like in real time.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's so exactly how I framed the book.
Yeah. So with that in mind, so the bulk of the book is covering kind of three major components of how Darwin understood natural selection. And so how would you respond to the person who kind of reads the book and says, well, I think this is actually anachronistic to take these modern categories that Darwin kind of is thinking about and forcing them onto the text? So that's question number one. And then related to that is, if it's not anachronistic and the biblical authors really are wrestling with these things that they're saying around them, then how did you in the book seek to organically just unfold these things as the Bible lays them out for us?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think they're anachronistic, because I noticed them in the biblical literature first. It was only later when I was reading something on natural selection where I was like, wait a second, this sounds very familiar to me. And, you know, I did kind of have an aha moment where I was like, wait, the biblical authors are talking about this. And then you have to ask the real question, how much are they? And you really do have to tread lightly and say, how do I know that I'm not projecting here? I have my own, I mean, you probably know this from my other book, but I have my own methodology for kind of holding myself in check and not just kind of, as we've seen people do, where they just kind of let it fly and kind of follow any rabbit trail of literature or language. So my standard is basically, if we're in narrative, then the narrative has to be in some way focused on this topic. And we can discover that by the structures of the narrative, by the conflict and the resolution patterns. We can discover that by character development. If character development happens around a certain topic, then we can say, okay, that's important to the narrator. Genesis 1 through 11, where I put a lot of the heavy lifting, is so terse. It has so little literature to it that when it focuses on something, it's basically an intentional act to not focus on a bunch of things, but focus on these instead. So, I mean, it's talking about the creation of the universe and kind of why everything doesn't work today in three chapters. So focusing very intently on what seems to be the intent of those chapters, you still get fertility and sexual propagation, and not just procreation, but like your great great grandchildren. What do you do today that accounts for how your great great grandchildren will live? People you'll never meet will live in the land, right? How do you keep your house? How do you keep your relations? What does the political state look like? And so I didn't feel like it was a stretch at all to say, like, okay, yeah, the curse of the man. Or the curse of the woman on fertility, the curse of the man on the fertility of the dirt, which creates scarcity, which creates a huge problem. I mean, he says by the sweat of your brow. I mean, you can't say, pardon me, I'm cheating also because I've lived in Israel and I know that these are kind of Israeli-centric texts, like they're thinking of the topography of that ground. And they, you don't have to tell an Iron Age agrarian subsistence farmer in the Levant why they're going to sweat to get bread out of the ground, right? That's going to be very obvious to them. And you know, if you haven't read Genesis lately, about half of it in the middle section is all about trying to make babies and get for generations living in the land, right? I mean, there's a giant baby-making competition between one man and four women that creates the 12 tribes of Israel. So, or 13, depending on how you count. So again, I didn't feel like it was a square peg to a round hole trying to like force this all to fit. I actually felt like when I kind of held the elements of natural selection in an open hand and just kind of said, like, is any of this, you know, in here? It kept on coming up in surprising ways over and over again. I was actually very surprised about how deep this discussion went in scripture. I mean, I had intuitions. I've been in that text for a decade or so, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I really, that was one of the things that I had never really noticed this connection of how, what the Bible's emphasizing and how that sort of maps on to answering some of these questions that people are asking. So I thought that was really well done. I want to get you to talk to me a little bit of a hot take, because that's what makes podcasts be listened to. One thing you mentioned, you called Ken Ham's work a flat reading of Genesis 1 and 2.
I meant to what say flaccid.
what does it mean, like, in your mind, like, what is Ken doing wrong?
I don't know what he's doing wrong, and I also don't know what his latest views are, so maybe he's changed his, like, you know, I saw a new movie
that's coming out about the ark, and then there's like a dinosaur that's like drowning in the water or something. I don't know if that's him, but it just immediately made me think of him, and so I was like, this is what I'm talking about.
That totally checks out though.
I have to admit here, I really loved reading all of Answers in Genesis work. I actually appreciate the fact that those people are out there like saying, what if not? Like, what if something else was going on? And I actually read a lot of their work very closely. And I'm, you know, maybe it's my own personality that I'm just like, I want to be with the people who are like, I don't know, maybe that's all wrong. And maybe there's something else that... So I appreciate that there are people out there doing that work. And I think they actually raise some very fascinating, I mean, every once in a while, you're just like, oh yeah, how do you deal with that piece of data, right? And it keeps the conversation going, which I think is good. Ken Ham, though, in his reading, and it's not just him, it's just a lot of people who are going to say, well, I just read Genesis for what it says, and it just tells a story. And I just say, and I'm like, well, great. I don't think you're reading it the way an ancient Iron Age farmer would hear the story. And I don't mean like, oh, we all have to pretend to be, you know, Iron Age Hebrew farmers. I mean, you know, when it says in the beginning, God said, let there be light, and there was light, an ancient Iron Age farmer, they were all rational people that believed in cause and effect. And they would say, light from where? Like, light comes from things. It comes from the sun reflected off the moon, it comes from lightning, or it comes from fire. I think an ancient Iron Age farmer, and then you go, okay, well, then there was an evening and then a morning, and the ancient Iron Age farmer is going to be like, how? There's no sun, moon, or stars. And they're like, oh no, that's day four, right? Like, so even when you read it, it has its own internally perplexing, like, what are you talking about? It talks about 7 days, and it ends the 7-day creation period by saying, these are the generations of the heavens and the earth in the day when they were created. It refers to it as one day, right? And so there's all kinds of genre-breaking elements where you can't quite place it as this. It's not a piece of poetry, although it has lots of poetic repetition. It's not a story, even though it does kind of have a something like a movement to a climax. It tells you that it frames it as a genealogy. This is the genealogy of the heavens and the earth in the day they were created. So this kind of like, I'm just going to read what the text says and just stick to what it says. I challenge anybody to make a movie of what the text actually says. I don't know where you would put the camera, what you would point it at, or I don't actually know what it's talking about in some places. Once it gets to the land separating from the waters, I'm like, okay, I'm with you. I understand what you're trying to do there. And by saying that, I don't want to do the cheap move to say, like, oh, none of these people actually believed any of this was true. I'm like, no, I think they all believed it was true. I mean, my reading of the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament is they all believe this was historically accurate to some extent, even if they might struggle with exactly how it's historically accurate. So I think they hold both in tension, that they believe something, this is in some way true to how the world was created and how creatures inhabited the world. But I don't know if people, if you were like the little child sitting in your dad's lap asking him, well, how exactly did this happen? Or I was on a podcast earlier today where the question was, did Adam and Eve know about babies? Like, did they have any cognizance of the potential of her getting pregnant? Mm-hmm. And basic questions like that are very difficult to answer from the text itself. Not to mention, like, how old were they? Had they gone through, were they created post-pubescent or pre-pubescent? The rabbis love to argue about all this stuff, right? So, and they come up with some, you know, pretty wild answers to these questions. So, I want to be careful. I'm not making that lazy move. Sorry, I don't want to call it late. So to me, it can sometimes feel like a lazy move to say, like, oh, these are just etiological explanations of where things came from. Or these are just taking a functional view of the universe and everything plays a function, so they're trying to explain all. Like, I think all of those things are in some way accurate to what the text is doing, but it seems to be very resistant to falling into any of the typical genres of the literature that, of the people that surrounded it, and it's doing something else. So I don't know what else to say besides that. Is it history? I'm like, not in the way we understand history, but I think Hebrews would have said, like, yeah, there's something historically true about what's being described here.
So along this line, and Cody, you tell me what you think as well. I'm curious, like, what does it look like to prioritize the mindset of the biblical authors and the original hearers in a way that appropriately prioritizes their frameworks and values, but without, like, giving up some of the advances that we've made since then? So for me,
yeah,
like,
I want to hear Cody answer that.
So, like, I want to prioritize, like, the creedal tradition. I want to prioritize the confessional tradition and say this is a faithful articulation and expansion of what it means to believe that Jesus is the Son of God, to what it means to believe that, you know, Jesus became incarnate and he has one person and two natures. I want to prioritize and allow those to be my frameworks for reading Scripture, but not in a way that smooths out the intentionally rough edges of Scripture. I'm still reminded by Con Campbell said something that will always stick with me, where he called systematicians systemagicians. And, like, the idea really, it's pointed in the fact that, like, you don't want to non-organically take these ideas from Scripture and just kind of, like, place it over it. But there's also the other sense of, like, you kind of have to assume some things. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, I mean, I think of the promise in John 17 where Jesus says the Spirit will guide us in the truth to be, like, that's an expansion of ever-growing knowledge and understanding of the truth. I don't want to have to constantly roll that back. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, maybe that's a question for both of you. I'm curious what your advice is on that.
Well, I'll say something really quick, and then I want to hear what Cody has to say. I think the creedal confessions are actually quite, at least the early ones, are quite guiding here because they don't say a lot, right? Like, they're the minimally sufficient statements. So Jesus died, was buried, and then later they're like, we should say that he descended into Hades. And then some people unfortunately call that hell. And then he rose again, right? And like, if you read those statements, or I would say the earliest creedal statement is Acts 15, right? Where they said, What must all Christians, Gentile or Jewish, understand? It's interesting. They go back to the Torah, sexual immorality from the Torah, and you can't abuse animals. Like, of all the surprising things from the Torah, they're like, yeah, you can't do this animal abuse thing, which makes me think that they were probably had an eye on kind of Roman culture and Roman practices at that point of, like, yeah, that's not going to sit with the Torah. So I think there's some ways in which theologically to prioritize creeds is actually to prioritize creedal method, which is to say the minimal sufficient things rather than, I mean, I don't know, I read a lot of theology, so I feel like European theology actually goes the other way and tries to say the maximal, like, let's exhaust the lines of reasoning on this. And by exhausting it, therefore, we have discovered what it actually is or what it's like. I don't know if you ever read Karl Rahner's Theological Investigations. They're super fun, 14 volumes. I've only read like two or three volumes. but or Barth's, you know, Church Dogmatics, or not, but it is not minimalist. I mean, there is some ways in which you see Barth trying to do this, like doing his exegesis and then trying to restrict himself to something he can say is true. But it seems like an opposite impulse. So yeah, sorry, I said that was going to be quick. It wasn't. Sorry, Cody.
No, you're good. I mean, the way that I think about the whole conversation, this kind of goes back to even the opening question of, you know, what to say to the person who's tense when they hear the name Darwin is, you know, if we want to affirm that all truth is God's truth and that natural, to use, I guess, systematic categories, if special revelation is always going to accord with natural revelation, if God's two books, as it were, cohere, then we shouldn't be surprised that that empirical science corresponds to what we see the biblical authors talking about. And the way that we privilege the biblical authors is essentially giving them their credit when it's due, of seeing that, no, the biblical writers are philosophizing and thinking about the world around them. And then under the inspiration of Spirit, they are pinning these things down over the course of centuries as they're experiencing really the real consequences of even what you've talked about in this book of fittedness and scarcity and propagate, like they're experiencing over the course of centuries and this happening to them and to their people. Mm-hmm. And the narratives that they are giving to us under the inspiration of the Spirit speak to those things, and they cohere with, you know, empirical reality that we can see in the real world. The two are not in competition. But I think because of particularly our context in, you know, modern America after the, you know, modern fundamentalist controversy, we do have this almost kind of antithesis approach to the Bible and science. Whereas if we just think about the world around us, this and the scriptures, we don't have to be afraid, and we can explore as freely as we see the biblical authors doing that. Like they are free in exploring these realities and opining upon them and giving their takes even via narrative. In the same way in which narrative can operate as Torah, as law, for the people of Israel, in the same way narratives can function as a means of philosophizing, like you got to in your prior book. And so,
yeah, can I add to that? Sorry.
Yeah.
It's one point he raised in my mind is to combine the points. Maybe if we thought of Genesis 1-3 as the minimal creedal statements of the Hebrews, of God through Moses, or who, I mean, I don't know who wrote Genesis. That's a whole other mystery, right? But that is, I mean, like they're talking about the biggest topic in the world, and like they're basically saying, here's what we think must be true in order for the rest to work, metaphysically, epistemologically, etc. And I think just valuing that as kind of creedal, which Jesus does, right? When people ask him about a divorce and sex, he's like, he doesn't go back to Leviticus 18 or 20. He goes back to Genesis 2 and says it was not so from the beginning, right? And then lines out the issues of sex from Genesis 2.
So am I being a bad reader of the Bible in this? Let me give you a test case. So you were talking about the Twitter rant on the soul in Genesis, the sort of the life, I guess the animating principle is sort of what you described it as, the breath of life. I would look at that and say, okay, I think I can take a sort of broadly Thomistic framework and say hylomorphism about human persons makes sense of this text, where the substantial form is sort of like an animating life principle. And so then I can build out sort of like a philosophical framework to say, okay, here's a more robust categorization of what human ontology entails that's hopefully growing out of what Scripture is explaining there, but it's not like sitting in the text and doing exegesis. Am I appropriately prioritizing them when I'm doing a project like that, or am I potentially creating problems for myself?
Yeah, I think Aristotle, like if you're going to go Greek, Aristotle's probably your best option here, because he cares about matter probably a bit more than the Neoplatonists do. I think where that goes wrong, like all that is fine, but Aristotle also believes in rational soul, and you know, this tripart division of the soul, and things are moving up and down within the soul. I think that's actually like the minimalist, the hylomorphic So I do think there's like the breath is the animating feature. There is some inner life. I don't think that they don't have a strong view or a discernible view to me. Maybe someone else has worked it out that I could be persuaded otherwise of something like a rational soul in the way that Thomas or vis-a-vis Aristotle means it. So I think finding that field within which all of these ideas work, but I, what I don't see is people saying, well, you see it with Thomas even putting up some fences and saying, oh, wait, I can't go down this far down the road with Aristotle. You know, the famous women are a misbegotten fetus or whatever, where he's like, yeah, Genesis does not allow me to affirm that.
Yeah.
But I think the move that I'm worried about is people starting with Thomas and trying to work it back to scripture, where I think theology should go the other way, where you get a really good sense. Like once you have a really good sense of what the biblical authors are doing, then you can kind of look around in the world, the conceptual worlds available to us, and you can slice and dice pretty quickly and go, that fits, that doesn't, that fits, that doesn't. If you start with our conceptual world or whatever that is, whatever your golden era is, then you have to do all of this like Rube Goldberg reverse engineering, trying to figure out, and or you end up theologizing like some students do with their ethics. They say, you know, well, what's so wrong with believing in a rational soul? Right? Well, what's so wrong with sleeping with my girlfriend? I'm like, by biblical definitions, you're asking the wrong question, right? Like that's not the route to wisdom. And so I do think methodology matters. And I think there are better and worse. And I think the better starts with scripture and works its way forward. And you can put like, look, not only can you put Darwin in conversation with the biblical authors, you can even put somebody like Thomas Aquinas in conversation with the biblical authors or John Calvin, right? And see how they fare. I think John Calvin would want you to. I'm sure Aquinas would too. So.
Yeah. So one thing I want you to talk to me a little bit about is just the work on trees in the book. I found this fascinating, and it made me remember when I was an MDiv student, my roommate decided to write one of his papers on like the trees in the Bible.
Mm.
And I remember thinking like, what are you writing a paper on trees? But then he like started explaining like how important they are like theologically mm-hmm. to the text. And I was like, oh, I've never seen that before. So I'd love the communicative element of the trees and all that stuff. I just found super fascinating.
Yeah, I did too. It's funny enough. I had a friend I did my PhD with. I was like, what are you working on? He's like, I'm working on a book on trees in the Bible. And I was like, same reaction. It's like trees. And then as I started walking it out, I was like, oh yeah. And then you get to Deuteronomy 20. It's like, you shall not wield an axe against a tree for, you know, it's not a person or whatever. And you're like, oh yeah, trees do have a special place in the economy of Israel. I don't even remember why I talked about them in the book. Maybe the issue of scarcity of resource, that trees have this unique ability. They think this is debatable, right? Like I did all this reading and research and it was exciting. And then a year later, when I went back to kind of touch up the research, I found out like it was a hot debate again, whether any of this was true or how true it was. But it seems that the basic truths here is that trees talk to each other through fungal networks. The question, I think there was a question as to whether they talk cross species or not, but trees can lend ingredients. You know, we walk on the forest floor and we think that, you know, that we think that what's good about a tree is above ground. And what they found is like below ground, there's all this stuff going on where they're actually, and even talking and communicating is a strong verb here, but it's a metaphor for they send signals to each other and can share nutrients across these networks with each other for the sake of the forest rather than the tree, right? Which is a very different model than natural selection, where you have scarce resources, you hoard or you fight to the death, red in tooth and claw. There's all kinds of models of cooperation in natural selection. That's if you were to pick one thing that modern evolutionary sciences quibble with, is they think there's a lot more cooperation going on than competition. I'm not like... Some of those stories are a little bit too romantic for me. I lived in the Amazon jungle for a while when I was in the military, and in Colombia. And, I hate to say it, but spend time in the Amazon jungle and then tell me how cooperative this world, it's like almost everything can kill you. And I'm not even talking about the animals. I'm just talking about the plants, you know, it's like, it's just a very dangerous place. And maybe I'm being a little too pessimistic, but, there's a lot more going on. And I think this is the point. I think this is the point I was trying to make in the book, is there's just more going on symbiotically between animals, plants, and between species then we realize that should lead a person who reads this research or hears the popular version like I did to conclude that we are all connected and bound in obligation to each other in more ways than we probably suspect. And I would say, but no more than the Torah would have already led you to believe. Like you could, in some ways, I would say theologically, you could get every single thing that these people are finding from the Torah itself as the ethical obligations of humans to the dirt, to other animals, etc. But that's my standard move that everybody gets sick of.
Yeah. So as kind of a closing question, as we wrap up, I found for me, the most interesting section of your book was actually the conversation you had about monogamy.
Oh yeah.
And propagation. I say that because, and I think this is particularly enlightening conversation in light of our current moment is like, I'm here in Auburn, Alabama. I talk to a lot of university students who are all beginning to say monogamy is not natural. And there's, it's, you know, it's traditional, it's archaic. It's just, you know, something that, you know, XYZ oppressor has enforced upon us. How do you think the biblical authors have that conversation? And then how may that help us even have that conversation today?
Yeah. So in some sense, we as Christians could say, you're right. It's not natural. There are two, like, depends on what you mean by natural. And of course, I have a huge conversation about what different people mean by natural in the book. So you could say there are two things in scripture that are not natural, the Sabbath and monogamy. The Sabbath, there's nothing, you know, days, months, years, all line up with stars or moon, sorry, with the sun or the moon, right? The rotation of the earth. There is no 7-day feature of creation at all. It's an artificial, part of creation, we should say. And same thing with monogamy. In some sense, you could say it's an artificial part of creation, except for, again, if you start in Genesis 1, the image of God himself is male and female, which that was more surprising to me, the scandal of sexual differentiation, that you have males and females that can have sex with each other. That was the most controversial thing in evolutionary biology, right? Is because this this is like where evolution went wrong. It's where it became inefficient. You know, it could have been another way. So the idea that I think the thing that was also intriguing to me, and this one like was one of those things like in the shower, I kept on like even the other day, I was still trying to puzzle it through, is that monogamy is good, not just in humans, but in other animal species as well. If you think about the health of their offspring over the long haul through generations, and it's typically a male who will, as I say, who will have sex but stay with the partner and play with the kids, as it were, raise the kids, see them into, you know, whatever the next phase is of adulthood for that species, that those children had the best outcomes, and their children and their children had the best outcomes. But when you stop and think about that, you think like, wait, how could anybody ever know that? How could, like, even as humans, how would you know that unless somebody had studied it and figured it out? You know, like, how would you know that? I mean, you even have to convince young people today, like, no, actually, a monogamous married, not just a cohabitation where it's casual, like, that will be the best thing for your great grandchildren. So that monogamy turns out to have all these pro-social and therefore health benefits. If, you know, if you can think about mental health, physical health, in the long run, that could just not be anticipated by anybody. And it's the hardest thing to do because your biology, like especially male biology, but not exclusive to male biology, because we are sexually differentiated and because males can inseminate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week until we're 80 years old, and women can only get pregnant, you know, like in a 2-day period once a month, right? The whole biological system is corrupted to basically not be monogamous. So there are some common sense ways in which it is very unnatural. But again, when some people came to Jesus looking to divorce their wives, he instantly goes back to sexual, like you want to have sex with somebody. I think he's presuming they want to have sex with younger women. They want to divorce their wives so they can offload their wives and go to younger women. Maybe not. Who knows? He goes back to Genesis 2 and says, actually, what you're suggesting is not natural. I mean, that's how I would say it in today's language. It's not actually natural. You are actually meant to be with that one person. And that is actually what is best for you over the long haul. I say all that also as a pastor who realizes there are some situations where you need to get out of marriage. Like that, that is not a universal rule of every relationship. That's a general truth. Yeah. And the Gottmans have found this too. Like people who study marriage, people who study, like among hominids and particularly humans, like these are non-Christians, people who just do intensive studies of marriage dynamics. They find this as well. Like, I don't think there's anything that scripture is advocating that hasn't been found by research to be generally supported. So
clearly we could probably talk for another 2 hours about topics related to the book. So what that means is you need to go purchase the book, support Drew and his work and his research.
Give me that dollar.
And become a better reader of scripture. And a better reader of the world as you think about these things and learn to inhabit what it means to be part of the world of scripture and the authors there. So, Drew, this has been awesome. I really appreciate you taking the time. It's a lot of fun. Remind me, where's the best place to go if people want to keep up with your work?
I don't think there's anybody listening to this that wants to keep up with my work. But I'm like, do I even have any work to keep up with at this point? If you want to track me, I'm on Twitter. But I have a website too. But that's just the narcissism hole. So,
yeah, I would say the Center for Hebraic Thought.
Oh yeah, well, let's see if that survives. Okay. We'll see.
I found it helpful. Other people should find it helpful.
Center for Hebraic Thought or the Biblical Mind. We're still posting stuff over there as well. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks, Drew. This was a lot of fun. Everybody who's been tuning in, check out Drew and his work and support it as you can. And we appreciate you all tuning in to the only analytic Baptist confessional podcast on the planet. And we look forward to talking with you soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.